From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Lots of people have their reasons for supporting the initiative to legalize recreational use of marijuana, but tax revenue is not one of the strong ones.
And once you divide it those three ways, you're talking a minimal impact.
Finally, we're just days away from elections.
It's been like a two-year campaign season, so I think everybody's very, very tired, but some of us are quite excited.
With young people moving from the suburbs into the city, there's a new interest in family roots.
Especially among the millennial generation, there is a growing interest in genealogy and just local history in general.
Then for at least one cocktail aficionado, vodka is not a favorite.
Odorless, flavorless, and colorless. It's meant to be very neutral and very smooth. So to me, it often doesn't add anything in a cocktail.
That self-proclaimed cocktail snob finds a really good use for vodka. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. After Election Day, the Michigan legislature is expected to take up the Michigan Paid Sick Leave Initiative that it passed in September. It's now law. Republicans plan to amend it. The Democrats say the Republicans' approach of approve and amend will be more likely approve and remove. Joining us to talk about the initiative as it was passed is Danielle Atkinson. She led the Michigan Time to Care group, which put the ballot initiative together. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first, how surprised were you that the legislature stepped in and approved the initiative, which was on its way to the ballot for a vote of the people?
You know, unfortunately, I wasn't surprised because we had suspected that they would do something to counter it getting to the voters and to blunt it before it could be on the ballot.
What did the initiative include?
So our initiative allowed people to earn 1 hour for every 30 worked so that they're able to bank time when they are well and working to take time off when they're sick and take care of themselves and their loved ones.
How many working people don't have paid sick time in Michigan?
You know, unfortunately, the vast majority of people in Michigan don't, and this would not only affect people who don't have earned sick time, but their children and people who have sick time, but whose children or go to work with people who don't have sick time. So really, it affects everybody in Michigan.
Who opposes paid sick time?
You know, we have people, we have the Chamber of Commerce who has come out very strongly against it. But we know that there is tremendous support for the issue. Obviously, everyone who signed our petition, but really the vast majority of Michiganders support earned sick time.
Now, there was no campaign money raised for the opposition effort, and you guys raised quite a bit of money and spent it to get the ballot initiative on the ballot. What does the fact that the opposition didn't raise any money tell you?
You know, I definitely think it speaks to the lack of support that they have for the issue or how unpopular it is to say that you oppose sick time. We know that everybody gets sick, but unfortunately, not everyone has time to get well. And it's really hard to say that you're against sick time, which is just really should be a basic human right.
Well, Majority Leader Alan Meekoff says Republicans will consider something more friendly to Michigan and economic development, but good for workers, too. Speaker of the House Tom Leonard says there's no plan to amend the paid sick leave law, but then he added the legislature does have the authority to change it if it wants to. What have you heard from legislators about their plans for the Time to Care initiative?
You know, we've been working on this issue for over 6 years, and there have been ample opportunities to have a debate, a public debate about this. But unfortunately, we've never gotten the chance to even have a hearing on this issue. And then when we were in the Capitol, knowing that they would pass this into law, we heard whispers of people saying a lot of different things, but nothing consistent about the changes. We know that they want to make it less friendly, less strong, and not what the voters were planning on when they signed a petition this summer.
If the legislature does gut the paid sick leave law in lame duck session, what options does Michigan Time to Care have at its disposal?
Yeah, look, we are here. We're fighting this fight. Right now, we are all about protecting the law that has passed, that is law of the land, by educating voters and asking them to hold their elected officials accountable for the law that they just passed. But if the time comes when this law is not what we need in Michigan, we will think about other things. We are definitely up for the fight. But right now, we're defending this law.
Danielle Atkinson led the Michigan Time to Care group, which put the paid sick leave ballot initiative together. It is to go into effect in March if the legislature doesn't kill the initiative. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us now are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator in Lansing. And Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former majority leader of the state Senate. So this is the last time we get to talk before Election Day. What are you going to be watching most closely on Tuesday? Vicki?
Voter turnout.
Yeah.
And we'll see how it goes. This has been it's been like a 2-year campaign season. So I think everybody's very, very tired, but some of us are quite excited.
I think some of these candidates have actually been on the road for nearly 2 years. Ken, what are you going to be keeping an eye out for?
Well, this is, I think, an unusual midterm election in that that even though Trump is not on the ballot, Trump is on the ballot. Because I just think nationally, this is by and large going to be a referendum on him and his policies and his behavior. And I think it's going to resonate down the ballot, even in the state legislative races. So that's kind of what I'm going to be focused on, both nationally and here in Michigan.
Let me ask you, too, about one particular campaign or race. How well do you think the candidates for governor ran their races? Vicki?
I'm extremely disappointed in the performance of Bill Schuette in the debates and his performance overall. I am a Democrat, and I think that Gretchen Whitmer will make an excellent governor, and I'm looking forward to her being our next governor. But to keep invoking the same sad, old, tired Granholm lost decade and the one state recession over and over again without really talking about what your policies are, what your goals are, how you hope to lift Michigan up and move us forward and continue the legacy of this great state was a lost opportunity for him.
Ken, what do you think, Ken? How did the candidates for governor do?
You know, I'm going to make my comments here and then say that, you know, the election is Tuesday, and if Schuette wins, then my comments are going to look pretty stupid. I don't think his campaign, it didn't seem to materialize or resonate very well, in my opinion. You know, when I think the issues are things like the condition of the roads, health care, the drinking water situation in Michigan, environmental contamination, you know, just to talk about cutting the income tax, just I just don't think it kind of resonates with people in terms of what they're thinking about or concerned about. But like I said, I mean, if he pulls a rabbit out of the hat and wins on Tuesday, then, you know, obviously, I don't look very smart.
Yeah, I don't like to comment on things like this, but I have to say I didn't see the Schuette campaign switch gears from the primaries into the general election. Did you guys see the same sort of approach?
It never did, and I think that's where the Whitmer campaign really came on strong. There was some concern at the beginning of the election season that she wasn't going to peak in time. But I think she's run an excellent campaign and stuck to her major issues, and that's healthcare, roads, and education, and making Michigan a better place in the environment. And that's the message that the Democrats have been using across the state, which resonate with voters. We've been living here with lead issues and cracked windshields, and I think she's finishing up with a little bit of humor. On the other hand, this has been a terrible week for Republicans, especially in the state of Michigan and in Pittsburgh and across the border to the south. So I think when you've got pipe bombs and a deadly massacre at a Jewish synagogue on the Sabbath, and the president doesn't stand up and begin to unite the country, and then it's followed up with a Pence visit, and instead of talking about bringing communities together, they bring in a messianic rabbi who is a Christian, and most Jews consider that kind of rabbi a Christian. They accept Jesus as their Messiah, was really tone deaf to the Jewish community. And the heart of the Jewish community is in Oakland County, Michigan. And it's been a real rough week here for the Jewish community and for Lana Epstein.
Ken Schuette's campaign, did you feel it stayed preaching to the base and forgot about the general election?
I think it's always hard for a Republican to pivot from the primary to the general, because in the primary, you try to appeal to the more conservative elements in your party. And then in the general, you've got to appeal to more independent and moderate voters. And it was a particular challenge this year because of Trump, you know, where Bill Schuette tied himself to Trump in the primary. And then the challenge of pivoting after the primary, I just think it was too much and overwhelming. And like I said, I just feel the campaign never really resonated much after the primary.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks for the time.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lester.
For the last month, we've been talking to Michiganders about the issues most important to them, and today we bring you our final two Voter Voices segments ahead of next week's election.
My name's Dan, and I'm from Canton, Michigan. As a Michigan voter, I think the most important issues for me at this time are getting the budget in line and getting equal rights for everybody, equal pay for women, and equal rights for everyone. I think the budget's important for Michigan because in order to get anything done, we need to have the funds for it. And for equality, it's America. We're supposed to be that and show the world that. What concerns me most? Political climate, I think, is so one way or the other with everyone, and people aren't wanting to meet in the middle and have discussions. And I think mostly people want the same kind of things, but it seems to be a society where everything's the extreme right or the extreme left.
My name is Charles. I live in Belleville, Michigan. What matters to me is equal opportunity for all people, women and people of color and other groups. I think it matters. It's always been an issue. We want a level playing field. That's not happening now. What concerns me is it's very divided, and I hope that division get resolved or get dissolved to some degree after the election, where Democrats and Republicans can come together. A house divided cannot survive. You know, you have to come together as a United States. That's what it means, United States, not separate states. So that's what it is.
Thanks to Sarah Leeson for recording those interviews. Stay with us. We'll hear more voter voices later in the show. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Housing prices are rising so fast and so high in some cities that families bringing in the median income, which is about $55,000 a year in Michigan, cannot afford to buy a home. More people are renting, and that's driving rent prices higher. So what do you do when your workforce cannot afford to live in your city? Among other cities, that's a real problem in Grand Rapids. Joining us to talk about that is David Allen. He's the executive director of Innova Lab, formerly the Kent County Land Bank. David Allen, welcome.
Thank you.
So how bad is the housing situation in Grand Rapids and the rest of Kent County?
From the industry experts that I listen to and that I speak to on an almost daily basis, historically bad. Real estate markets are generally gauged by how much inventory is available in the market, because that's, you know, supply and demand. That's what determines the price. And so the inventory levels in West Michigan, Grand Rapids area, is hovering right around less than 1 month worth of inventory, which is a healthy market will have anywhere from 3 to 6 months worth of inventory. Hmm. Matter of fact, USA Today just came out in the recent weeks with the 10 hottest real estate markets in the United States of America, and the hottest market in the United States of America was Kentwood. They had like 2 days worth of inventory on the market.
Some of the problem, as I understand it, is out-of-state investors buying up properties. In fact, some of them have purchased homes from your organization. All they want is a really good return on their money, which, you know, is capitalism. But what's the net effect of those investors buying up homes in Grand Rapids?
To be honest with you, Lester, I think we're past that point. Historically, we're long past the mortgage loan housing crash. That's when those investors were buying. They were buying large pools from large banks. They've typically, most of those single-family homes have either been absorbed into the rental market, or they've actually, in many cases, sold them for home ownership opportunities. The market has gotten so high, they've cashed in and gotten out. So really, out-of-state investors right now doesn't really appear to be a major cause.
What role should land banks like InnovaLab play in making sure there are homes that the working class can afford?
I think that's probably the most important question. All the land banks in the state of Michigan, and there's about 40 of them, operate under the auspices of the State Land Bank Authority. Josh Brigett is the director there. And last year at our leadership conference, all the leaders of all the land banks get together. Josh made it very clear to all the land banks that we own a lot of buildable land in the state collectively, and that if we're not about building properties or getting homes built on these properties for working class families to afford, then we're missing the mark. If all we're doing is collecting blighted properties and tearing properties down, we've missed the mark. We need to be about development. So we believe at InnovaLab, and we're carrying that out, and I think through partnership with the State Land Bank, that we're going to seize on that opportunity to get homes built on these lots.
Right. Your group has been putting up modular homes on empty lots. How well is that working?
It's really been amazing, honestly, from a price perspective and from a timing perspective. From start to finish, we can get a house ordered and on the lot and fully ready to be occupied within 3 months. We're seeing a cost per square foot at about $100 to $110 a square foot, whereas new construction's costing between $150 and, in some cases, $200 a square foot. But most importantly, even if you did want to stick build a house today, the workforce in the trades is just so in such dire need. Most people are even having a hard time finding contractors. So modular home construction, which is not manufactured home, I'll be real clear on that. These are not mobile homes. These are stick-built homes off-site that are, in most cases, higher quality than what you would be able to build yourself, are able to be done quicker, more cost-effectively, and then the land banks, because our cost of land is zero, we're passing on that savings to the buyer. So we're able to sell homes in that $169,000 to $229,000 range for working-class families, and that's really been our goal and what we've been focused on.
I'm glad you made the distinction between modular and manufactured, but still modular homes for a lot of people has, you know, have different looks. I know in my hometown there were a lot of modular homes that all look like ranches. What are these modular homes you're putting up look like?
That's a great question. Fairly soon on our website, innova-lab.org, we're going to have all of our models. We've been working with Champion Homes, which is the largest modular home manufacturer in the nation, and we have designed specific designs that fit into the urban context. For example, we just placed three homes a few months ago. One is in a traditional neighborhood, and it's a traditional, if you looked at it today, you'd never know that it was installed with a crane. One is on a cul-de-sac with all ranch-style homes, and it's a really beautiful ranch-style home that fits in that neighborhood. And the other is in a more historic neighborhood, so it's a tall, skinny front-to-back. So we've got designs that really will fit into any urban context. I think that modular home construction for urban infill lots is really the answer right now to get. No one's ever going to solve the housing crisis. It's too dire, but I think we can make a dent in it.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a little bit. I'm just wondering, how unusual is it for a land bank to be taking on the role of an affordable housing developer?
Actually, it's not that unusual, to be honest with you. I could point to the Kalamazoo County Land Bank. In Kalamazoo County, there's not a lot of really high volume nonprofit housing providers, and the Kalamazoo County Land Bank serves that role and serves it quite well. I think in a couple of other areas, the land bank concept is being looked to meet this need, because the government funding for affordable housing is drying up. Therefore, a lot of nonprofit housing corporations are kind of going by the wayside or slowing down their production or focusing just on large-scale low-income housing tax credit projects. There's really a missing gap right there, and I think land banks play a key role in filling that.
Are your efforts actually making a real difference, a significant difference, or is the gap between housing costs and the average paycheck in Kent County simply too great to overcome in any significant way?
I'd be hard-pressed to say we're going to make a significant difference, but I will definitely say we are making a difference. We have about 125 buildable lots. We've got, by the time we get to Thanksgiving, we will have built 13 homes on those in a matter of about 6 months. That's some pretty significant inventory coming to the market, and I think it will at least help. I can definitely assure you of that.
So if you're having some success with this, are there other cities that could learn from your example?
Yeah, I think so. The State Land Bank has turned to us and has actually partnered with us to help. The State Land Bank on its own owns right around 4,000 to 5,000 lots around the state in areas where there weren't land banks or before there were land banks. And they're working with us closely, and we're helping them implement this modular model in other areas that have a similar housing need.
So we've been talking about the downside, but I imagine, you know, being a hot real estate market, there's got to be an upside to this. Unfortunately, it's not going to be for the working class folks, but it's good for Grand Rapids?
Oh, I think so. I definitely think so. And what's missed in this conversation, Lester, and I do not want to downplay in any way, shape, or form the thousands of families that are trying to find housing, but the one piece that I think is not being discussed is in many of these urban neighborhoods, they're still maintaining a 50 to 55% home ownership rate, and most of those homeowners who live in that neighborhood have lived there 40, 50 years, many of them being African-American and Hispanic families who moved in, and then the white flight happened, and they saw their values go down. Now, all of a sudden, their values are going up, and in many cases, those families are turning those homes onto their children, and that's their family's legacy. That provides wealth for families. And I think it certainly is hurting families that are trying to find housing, but for the existing homeowners who've seen their values go bad in these, some of these more traditional neighbors, they're seeing it come back, and I think that's a good thing over the long haul.
David Allen is the executive director of Innova Lab. Thanks very much for talking with us.
No problem. Anytime.
Genealogy has long been a popular pursuit, and for decades, family research happened almost exclusively at the local library. Now some new avenues are popping up: online services, DNA services, and a lot more. And with them comes a new wave of interest in family histories. Here to talk about that are Tim Gleisner, the Special Collections Manager at the Library of Michigan, and Chris Ripsinski, Senior Archivist at the Archives of Michigan. They kick off our new monthly segment looking at the treasures you can find in libraries across the state. So here's a question for you guys. I was doing some research a couple of decades ago on a project that took me to a lot of local libraries, and the people researching their genealogy were generally retired senior citizens. Is that still the case, or are there younger people pursuing their family history with this new wave of interest?
I mean, I would say that, yes, there are many senior citizens out there, but the thing that I find, there is a growing interest, especially among the millennial generation. There is a growing interest in genealogy and just local history in general, really discovering their roots. And what's even more amazing, just discovering their community's roots, really looking at the story and, again, how their families fit within the overall community story. And so I know in Grand Rapids, it was a huge thing. In Detroit, it's a huge thing, especially with the inward migration of the younger generations coming back into these cities, wanting to know what the city was like, but also what their ancestors were doing in those places at that time and what the place might have felt or looked like. So yes, there is a growing interest, especially amongst the millennial generation.
I would agree with that too, because you have a, with the instant access for online resources and things that either websites like Seeking Michigan or at local public library websites and the amazing content they're able to put online at their sites, users and millennials and folks of all age groups can find easily those stories for their community and for their ancestors.
Online resources might be what's sparking this new wave of interest in genealogy, but I know libraries still have a lot else to offer. What kind of resources does the Library of Michigan or archives, or for that matter, local libraries, have that would help people in researching genealogy?
I mean, I guess for the Library of Michigan, the first pot I would look at is the newspaper collection. The newspaper collection is one of the most comprehensive of newspapers around the state of Michigan. Virtually every county, we have a newspaper here on file. And accessible to anybody who wants to come in.
As far as the Archives of Michigan, primarily what we emphasize are the primary source documents from the state of Michigan. So these would be original records, things like tax records, things like naturalization records. These are those original records that were filed with the county or filed with the state, those primary documents that serve as the foundation and backbone to family history research. You also complement that with the Abrams Foundation historical collection that we have, which would be published materials, things that you would find on the shelf in a research institution or research library, county histories, cemetery transcriptions, things done by researchers and by local genealogical societies.
And then at the Library of Michigan, I would also add the Michigan collection, where we basically try to go out and get any governmental publication or any publication around the state, be it a magazine, book, whatever, you know, is on the topic of the state of Michigan. Or by an author of Michigan as well that we collect here. And then for local public libraries, there are libraries and institutions around the state like the Grand Rapids Library, the Laudit Library in Grand Haven that have tremendous genealogical collections. and some so specified, like in Alpena, if your ancestor was in, you know, the shipping industry in the Great Lakes, their maritime collection in Alpena is just a gold mine of information.
Now, one of the things that I think a lot of people find frustrating is there are a lot of data points, but there might not be a lot of stories about your ancestors. Are there sources for that? I know some during the turn of the last century, there were a lot of people going around doing local history books for counties. Are those helpful at all?
They can be, certainly. Not everyone's story is going to be in those books. Sometimes you have to fill in the gaps when you're doing genealogy. But yeah, in some of those, definitely. Some there are stories out there. I think what's amazing now are the stories that are being collected, like at the Archives of Michigan. They're starting to collect stories. There are institutions out in different communities of the state that are collecting their people's stories, like at the Herrick Library in Holland. They're collecting Latino stories out there for the migration of Mexican Americans that have been coming to that city for many years.
Are you talking about oral histories?
Yes.
So do families offer family documents to you, or what would be valuable for state archives?
Well, if we could take a step back for just a second, I think the one thing that it's important for your listeners and for everyone to realize is that every document has its own story. The context to why an ancestor or why someone chose to become a U.S. citizen, why they first settled in a particular area of the state of Michigan. And I think using those kind of primary source documents and published materials, putting them all together, you often wouldn't find one source having all of the answers. And so it's looking at multiple sources at multiple different access points, whether it's at a state institution, whether it's a local public library, kind of putting them all together and kind of synthesizing them together and having a better understanding about a particular family member or a particular family, a particular community, learning that larger narrative, learning that larger story that everyone has to tell.
And I think also, you know, what I would add to that is just that overall theme of history, right? Like getting your personal connection to, you know, the westward migration, or, you know, the migration from the south during the Great Migration, adding your story to that overall narrative is just a wonderful experience.
Are either of you genealogists?
Yes.
So tell me a good story about your family.
I think the most recent story for me is finding out that my great-grandmother was an illegitimate daughter of the family that she was working for, and then basically eventually was able to redeem herself later on in life. But nobody had ever known that story until a recent trip to a genealogical collection and finding out that story, and finding out that parts of my family did know parts of that story but never really talked about it.
We've been talking to Tim Gleisner, the Special Collections Manager at the Library of Michigan, and Chris Ripsinski, the Senior Archivist at the Archives of Michigan, and we've been talking about this new wave of interest in genealogy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
It's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we are trying out a cocktail, but this has an ingredient that, having taken your cocktail classes, I know you haven't used a lot, and that's vodka. Why don't you use vodka very much?
So for me, cocktails are all about the interplay of flavor, and that's what I like in cocktails, is seeing how different ingredients interact. And vodka as an ingredient doesn't bring anything of its own. It is, by law, odorless, flavorless, and colorless. It's meant to be very neutral and very smooth. To me, it often doesn't add anything in a cocktail. Now, that said,
everybody's arguing, no, it brings alcohol, though.
That's true. It does. I should correct myself. It doesn't add anything other than alcohol to a cocktail. Now, that said, there are some places that I think it can shine and that it can allow other ingredients to play off of each other without interrupting them the way another spirit would.
What vodka are you using and what are you featuring it in?
So this is the vodka from Long Road Distillers out in Grand Rapids. And the cocktail is called the Ramona, and I stumbled across this online, I don't know, a bunch of years ago. And I do a lot of private events, and not everybody is ready for really ambitious cocktails. They know they like vodka, but they want to try something that's still a little bit different. And so this allows people to have something that's familiar to them and then combines it with some interesting flavors in interesting ways.
What kind of interesting flavors?
This is going to play up a couple flavors that we associate with fall, and that's apple cider and sage.
Oh, nice. Well, that explains the sage leaf that's floating in the cocktail glass, which is very pretty, by the way.
Right, and this is a good example of the role that vodka can play, because this drink is really all about the interplay between sage and apple cider and a little bit of lemon juice, and the vodka doesn't get in the way of that. So you really are just experiencing those flavors coming together in a way that you've probably never had them before.
This sounds like a fairly simple drink to make. How did you make it?
So first you take half an ounce of lemon juice and about 5 sage leaves. It really depends how big your sage is. So, you know, some medium amount of sage, and muddle those in a cocktail shaker. You don't want to break up the sage into a pulp. You just want to bring out the aroma. So a few muddles with your muddler. And then I added a half an ounce of simple syrup, 1.5 ounces of the vodka, 1 ounce of apple cider. Shake it up, strain it into a cocktail glass.
You did use Michigan apple cider, didn't you?
I did use Michigan apple cider.
That's good. That's good. So, can I take a sip?
Please.
Oh, that sage right on your nose right away before you even get the glass to your mouth.
Right, and there's a trick with that. Anytime you're garnishing a drink with a fresh herb like sage or like basil, you just want to take that, flatten the palm of your hand and give it a good smack. And then that's going to bring out the aroma immediately to people as they bring it to their nose.
You're right. You can tell the vodka is there because you can always tell alcohol in your mouth, or usually you can anyway. So it's there, but it's really way in the background. It's all about the lemon juice, the apple cider, and the sage. There's just not much else there, but it's nice. It's refreshing for a fall drink.
Right, and it's a fall drink that everyone can appreciate, even if they're not a cocktail snob like me.
Okay, well, cheers.
Cheers.
Up next, we'll get an in-depth look at Proposal 1. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Midterm elections are now just days away. Over the past few weeks, we've been looking closely at the proposals on the ballot, and today we're going to focus on Proposal 1, which, if approved, would legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Joining us now is Eric Lufer. He's the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Good to see you again.
Lester, it's great to be back with you.
So you did an analysis, CRC did an analysis of this proposal. Let's try to go through this step by step. This would legalize recreational use of marijuana for whom?
For adults. The group that's pushing it calls themselves the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. And this is one of the similarities that, like alcohol, you can only consume it if you're 21 years or older. You can only legally purchase it if you're 21 years or older. If you're caught with it younger than that, regardless how you got it, it will still be illegal.
So not 18, 21. So
21
is like alcohol. How much could a person possess?
So they could possess 2.5 ounces, and they can grow up to 12 plants. They can have more than that on their property, but it has to be locked away. So if you're driving, you know, you have to have the precautions. You can't have it on your body or whatever.
So it's like a sealed container, like alcohol.
Like alcohol.
You might want to have to put it in a lockbox or something.
Lockbox, yeah. In the trunk, somewhere like that. So there's, you know, sort of that issue. 12 plants, once they're fully mature, can produce more than that. And there's a question what you do with it. But, yeah, we're talking 2.5 ounces, which is a fairly good size amount.
And on the growing of the plants, I saw there are some restrictions, too. You can't let your neighbors see what you're doing, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Which might be what's happening already.
Right? I mean, so with alcohol, you go to the party store, whatever, you buy it, people see you carrying it out, it's not sort of a big deal. This is really geared as an individual liberty for people to be able to consume it in their own property in their own way. So the growing of plants should be away from public view. You're not allowed to consume it in public places, not in schools, not at parks, not at concerts, anything like that. So that's, you know, sort of different than alcohol, where they encourage the sale of alcohol at a concert or things like that. But it's meant to be for your own use in your own place.
If you grow it, can you share it with somebody?
In small amounts. You know, there's still the presumption that you'll have parties or social events and be able to consume each other's. But if they allowed the large amount of sharing, then you'd say, well, you know, here's a bag, oh, by the way, sell me this this pencil or something, and you're just evading evading the tax laws and the regulatory structure, things like that. So,
well, it's good you bring up tax laws, because proponents talk about the revenue benefits to the state. There would be a 6% sales tax and then a 10% excise tax on marijuana. It's been suggested that additional money would help fix the roads, help support the schools. How much actual money would this sale of marijuana bring into the state? Do we know yet?
So it's sort of ballparking it, because we don't know how much people consume now. We don't know how much the market will grow if you make it legal. So it's sort of picking a number out of the sky, but it's an educated pick of a number out of the sky. And the estimates are $150 to $200 million. So the first amount of money will go to the regulatory structure and administering this. That's more upfront cost than back-end cost to sort of figure that out. And then there's going to be some money go to some studies to figure out if this really can help veterans and deal with PTSD and prevent veteran suicide. The money that's left goes to local governments, goes to roads, goes to schools. And once you divide it those three ways, you're talking a minimal impact, you know, enough to...
Yeah, $30 million is not going to fix the roads.
Yeah, you're talking about 30 miles of road in a state that has hundreds of thousands of miles of roads. So just like the lottery didn't fix schools, these are not the be-all, end-all to deal with our road and school needs.
How would the legislation of recreational marijuana affect the black market that I think it's fair to say thrives now in Michigan?
And everywhere. Really, the marijuana industry has existed in the black market since the 1930s. It'll be diminished. I think a lot of people, given the choice to purchase from the black market or purchase from a dispensary where they can sort of know what they're buying, the potency, the cleanliness of it. There's no, you know, chemicals in it mixed in, things like that. I think a lot of people will choose that route. But there's others who will not, and you still have the ability to grow your own. So it's not going to remove the black market, I think, is the main takeaway here. And one of the things that we were thinking about is northern Michigan, where you might have to travel long distances to get to a dispensary. Now you have the 10% tax, the 6% sales tax, and the cost of the ride, the gas to get there, your time. It sort of creates an incentive, I think, for northern Michigan to maintain that black market and continue to grow their own.
The CRC report indicated that under current laws, and I was surprised to see this, the number of annual arrests for marijuana possession has exceeded arrests for all other violent crimes combined. So how would the legalization affect law enforcement resources?
So that's an important part. And I want to differentiate sort of the public safety from the criminal justice. So we know that a lot of people will end up with misdemeanors for small possession, things like that. That affects their ability to get jobs. It affects their ability to do a lot of things. So lessening up the public safety aspect to allow the police to concentrate on traffic and crime and other aspects and don't worry about the possession of marijuana will be a useful element of this, given the scarce resources they have. But not that many people are prosecuted. And when you look at the prison population, how many people are actually locked away because of marijuana, it's a very small percent of the total prison population. So we're getting for misdemeanors, only the drug dealers, the people dealing with large volumes are being locked away, and that's a small number.
I was wondering if the effort that takes in arresting people with small amounts, that possession charge, is going to be the same in just monitoring and watching for people who are under the influence or smoking in the wrong places. I mean, is it going to be a wash as far as law enforcement resources?
You know, we don't know enough from the other states that have legalized before us to really be able to answer that. But certainly, it won't be a complete washout. Let's put it that way, that there still will be cost of public safety to deal with drug driving, to deal with open possession, to deal with people acting irrationally because they're high and doing things they shouldn't be doing.
A recent Bridge Magazine article on Proposal 1 indicated Michigan employers are, quote, flummoxed about what to do if it passes. What are the concerns of employers?
So under the proposed laws, employers have the same rights that they have now. If they wish to have a drug-free workforce, they will be able to test even after passage of this proposal if it happens. Right now, we know there's a labor shortage. So a lot of employers can't find enough people to staff to be at full productivity. So if this law happens and people can legally use, will there be more people coming in that have alcohol or have marijuana in their system and cannot therefore pass the drug test to be part of the workforce for many employers? So given that we have a shortage now, will this accentuate the shortage and make things worse?
It reminds me of, I was talking to a machine shop training school that indicated half of the applicants were refused because of failing the drug test. And they said they might as well learn now that they're not going to get a job if they, so why waste our time or our resources on them because they won't be able to get a job in the machine shop anyway.
I hear the same sort of stories that people can't find enough people to fill the spots. And many of the applicants that come in seem very capable of doing the work, but they can't pass the drug test. And that's a problem that we're going to make worse with this.
What if my village or city doesn't want marijuana sold on Main Street? What kind of local control is there?
There's very strong local control with this, that local governments are presumed to allow this. With medical marijuana, local communities had to opt in. With this act, all communities are presumed to have opted in, but they can pass an ordinance to say they don't want dispensaries or grow facilities or those types of things in their jurisdiction. The money that's distributed from the tax will only go to those that do have dispensaries, do have commercial businesses. That sort of creates an issue going forward. I can go to Ann Arbor and purchase maybe and take it back to my home somewhere else. And now those police departments, even though they're not getting the money, are still going to have to deal with the drug driving and other issues related to this. So communities can opt out of it, and we think many of them will, as they have chosen not to be part of the medical marijuana community. But there is strong control here.
This proposal says marijuana should be regulated like alcohol, but determining whether a driver is actually impaired or actually just has residential marijuana chemicals in his or her system, it's not as easy as testing for alcohol where you do the breathalyzer test. How would law enforcement regulate that?
Well, we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And law enforcement's trying to figure this out all throughout America and frankly all throughout the world. As you say, they can pull somebody over if they suspect irrational driving, they're weaving, they're going too slow, whatever it may be, pull them over, and if they suspect the use of marijuana can give them a test. That test, as you say, will indicate marijuana has been consumed, but not when it's been consumed. It's not a great indicator if somebody is impaired that would keep them from driving. So there are some tests being developed. They're not very reliable yet. A lot of times that road test will lead to taking them back to the station and trying to do something that's more reliable. But that's the big hurdle for public safety is to try to figure this out. The research we've done, it doesn't look like there's an answer on the horizon anytime soon.
As your analysis indicates, there have been some wildly exaggerated claims about marijuana in the past. You quoted or referenced the 1936 Reefer Madness cult film. But a lot of law enforcement agents and officers in this state still believe it's a gateway drug. They think it's a serious thing. They're against this proposal. What are the public health and safety concerns of legalizing recreational use of marijuana as far as it going further? And are police going to have the same attitude toward the drug they do now, even though it's legal?
So I don't know the attitude. I think.
Yeah, you don't measure that. It doesn't quantify very well, does it?
Well, yeah, and time will tell. I think things happen and police adapt and they'll have to roll with this. So is it a gateway drug? There is indications that people who are using more harsher drugs, heroin, cocaine, that type of thing, started with marijuana. But frankly, before that, they started with tobacco and alcohol. So those could be thought of as gateway drugs as well. But not everyone that consumes tobacco, alcohol, or marijuana goes on to use harsher drugs. And the question is there causation? And that's what the scientists don't know at this point. It could be that those people are predisposed to addictions and they're always looking for a stronger high. It could be that because they're using marijuana, they're in a crowd where somebody has those other drugs available to them, and it could be just a matter of convenience. There's a lot of things related to this. There is not clear causation at this point.
What happens if a big marijuana grower is kind of like big tobacco, come in, they set up shop? You know, we've seen that kind of influence on these big industries before, that they have on legislation, on regulation and things like that. How does the state deal with that if big money comes along with marijuana legalization?
Well, I think the biggest thing is sort of where we started. What happens to the black market? You could see big marijuana, air quotes around that, trying to do more to make sure that everything is produced commercially, sold commercially, trying to restrict the access to marijuana from people growing their own or the black market type of thing. Is that good or bad? That's sort of in the eye of the beholder, I guess. What happens then to taxation? Will there be some control on the regulatory side? Will they be doing more to sort of help that commercial grower as opposed to the everyday, you know, sort of mom and pop shop that most dispensaries are today? California is the most mature market with this. They haven't really seen that to a great extent. They've taken great controls to make sure they can follow from seed to sale, know exactly what happens. But that's more on the regulatory side than on the industry leading the government through this. Again, it remains to be seen.
If Michigan's Proposal 1 is approved by voters, marijuana use is still against federal law. How does that play out?
You know, that's a good question. The Obama administration took a very lax attitude and said this is a states' rights thing. Let's let them decide. When President Trump came in and Attorney General Sessions, there was some pushback and maybe some indications that they were going to rein this in. They quickly heard from the states where it's been legalized to say, wait a second, we're building our industry around this. We're building tourism. This is part of our economy now. And for you to take a harsh role with this would negatively affect those states. There's some indication that the federal government is thinking a little more about the proper use of medical marijuana, still wanting to make illegal the recreational use. But I think this is going to vary from presidency to a presidency, Congress dealing with this on a sort of stop and go manner going forward. It definitely means you can't take it across state lines. So alcohol, you know, happens and they want to control it, but they're not out there looking for it so much. I think they're going to be very vigilant watching the Michigan-Ohio border, the Indiana-Wisconsin. What grows in Michigan should stay in Michigan as far as those other states are concerned.
Eric Lufer is the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. You can find the Proposal 1 analysis at crcmich.org. That's crcmich.org. Thanks very much.
Thanks again.
And now here's our final Voter Voices segment ahead of next Tuesday's election.
I'm Rach Albright from Adrian, Michigan. I do absentee ballot, so it's been in for weeks. I'm strictly a Trump person, so.
Are you concerned about today's political climate, and if so, why?
No, because I believe it's all in God's hands.
My name is Mohammed Harani. I live in Dearborn, Michigan, and I am a software engineer. The biggest issues for me as a Michigan voter, they probably propagate down to the absurd amount of gerrymandering that goes on in the state. So it's very, very difficult for certain people to vote within a, I'd say, region that's convenient for them. They make it inconvenient for specific agendas. I would have to say that America's political climate today is akin to the common reality TV show. It's just the fact that everything is kind of fabricated and it's kind of made to mislead people or just occupy them, to entertain them. Politics today in America is entertainment.
Thanks to Mike Blank and Rozzy Joffrey for recording those interviews, and to all the producers across the state who contributed to this segment, and of course, the voters who shared their perspectives with us. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who tells me he's been sipping something odorless, flavorless, and colorless. Wonder what that could be. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Natalie Brennan, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.